This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us here as we discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Some intrigue in Europe as Italy installs a new prime minister and then Spain loses its prime minister. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's been a bit of a roller coaster week. I mean, it's been a bit of a roller coaster these last couple of weeks, at least for Italy. It kind of feels like we're having to do updates on that on a weekly basis. The good news is, if you're fed up of hearing about Italy, they have their prime minister now. Finally, he was sworn in today. It's a done deal. I think normally I'm here talking about what seems to be about to happen.
Yeah,
he's in now. They've got Giuseppe Conte. He was sworn in. So to kind of recap, he was about to be sworn in last week, and then the president stepped in and said no. He said that he objected to the finance minister, Paolo Savona. Savona was too Eurosceptic for Italy's prime minister. Savona, he's called the Euro Germany's cage. He said that Germany didn't change its ideas on its role in Europe at the end of Nazism, even if it abandoned the idea of imposing itself militarily. So you know, he's very anti. He talked about getting a plan B ready to get Italy out of the Euro. And the president stepped in and said, no. That's an unacceptable view for a finance minister to hold. That leaving the euro could, in his opinion, prove catastrophic to Italian savings. That's not allowed.
Which is an extraordinary development for the president to basically say, we have to make sure that we're not riling Germany up in this process.
Right. I mean, he's essentially he's in a constitutional gray area. He does have the power to block appointments, but generally it's because of objections to the individual. Every other time it's been used, like, this individual has a conflict of interest. This individual lacks the background or the ability to do the job. This is the first time that the prime minister has ever said this belief mm-hmm. is outlawed.
Right.
And that power doesn't exist to block beliefs. The president, you know, he wasn't even democratically elected. He was kind of put in through a backroom dealing between political parties. And so, you know, this is unprecedented. People have called it a soft coup or a quiet coup. They've said it's a constitutional gray area. And you look at his argument, and why is objecting to the euro dangerous for Italians or potentially dangerous to Italian savings? It's because any other time anybody's toyed with getting out of the euro, Germany stomped on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we saw this in Greece when they held their referendum. They voted to defy Europe, and the next day the prime minister caved into Germany. Mm-hmm. We saw this in Italy even, where in 2011, Italy's prime minister was deliberately forced out by France and Germany. France and Germany got together with the European Central Bank. They said, we're going to manipulate the bond market. We're going to manipulate the interest rate that Italy pays on its debts, because we want to get rid of a prime minister, and we're not going to stop manipulating it until Silvio Berlusconi is gone. And that's what happened. And a European official basically was parachuted in, Mario Monti, to be the next prime minister. So you saw something very similar happening again.
Right.
That was Tuesday.
Yeah, this was just, I guess you had an article on the website just a couple of days ago saying this was a real demonstration of just how much power Germany has. The fact that Italy would make this move, that the Italian president would essentially remove this individual because of something that would be ideologically different than what Germany wants. And yet, here we are 2 days later, the prime minister is put in place. So what happened in the interim?
Right. So what I said in that article is kind of like, well, Germany's won this battle, but they've not won the war. There's a whole lot more to play out. they have stopped this government for now, but they've still got lots of levers. So what they did is they came up with what seems like a pretty small compromise, really. So the Italian, the proposed coalition, at first they said, well, that's it. We're going to go for fresh elections. We won't support this. Then they said, OK, well, what if we don't give Savona, this guy you don't like, we won't give him the finance ministry. We'll give him the Europe, like basically like a minister for Europe. It's a much more low profile job. And we'll give the finance minister to another guy, Giovanni Tria. And Tria, you look at what he said, and basically he seems to pretty much be on the same page as Savona. And it seems like he agrees with Savona in general. But he's not been quite as outspoken in the same way. You know, he's not said the euro is a continuation of the Nazis' plans for Europe in the same way that Savona has. I mean, he has said that Europe is a rigged competition, and he said it favors Germany. He's talked about having a debate to get for all of Europe on whether they should abandon the euro. He's said, yes, some countries do need to leave the euro. But again, not quite as strident as Savona. So they put him up as the candidate for the finance ministry. And the president accepted that. So they've got this small compromise, and so now the government's sworn in, and in a lot of ways now the fun starts. They're going to start putting forward their proposals. Germany will probably agree with them. Exactly when a confrontation would take place, I don't know. I mean, this could still go on for several months.
You said that Germany would probably agree with them, but it seems likelier that there would actually be some kind of conflict between the Italian government.
The president's agreed for now.
Yeah. Essentially just sets up future confrontation between Italy and Germany at some point. Exactly when that happens, we don't know, but it's definitely something that we can expect to happen.
I think so. The only possible exception is maybe this compromise has signaled that they are going to back away from confronting Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw that in Greece, where you had a government that was really outspoken about confrontation with Germany, and they were persuaded to back down. And I think a lot of that persuasion took place behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the possibility that something like that has happened, and they're now being allowed to proceed because there's been a compromise that we just don't know about yet. But barring that, it does seem like at some point down the line, there will be some kind of confrontation with Germany. Because how can you have a common currency with one country that believes the government should be bringing in money, spending less than it gets in taxes, like Germany, and then you've got another one that's talking about printing more money, borrowing double times Europe's limit on deficit, on debt spending. So, you know, two can't walk together unless they be agreed, and these different countries couldn't be more disagreeing.
So quite a lot going on here, but at least by the end of this week, it ends on somewhat of a conciliatory note, whereas what's happening in Spain is kind of the opposite.
Right. So, yeah, you have for the first time in Spanish history, a sitting prime minister ousted in a vote of no confidence. So, yeah, never happened before. And the reason why this has been able to happen is very similar to what's going on in Italy, this just unstable era of political systems. Marino Rajoy, he is the prime minister that's been ousted. He was, I think, about two seats short of having a majority in the European Parliament, in the Spanish Parliament. He's been able to get by so far. There was a corruption scandal. There was some more details, and parts of that came out last week. And the opposition was able to use that to put a vote of no confidence and win it. And it was a really close vote, but he's now out. But this puts Italy now in a really unstable position. The incoming prime minister leads the Socialist Party. He's a very far left group, the Pedro Sanchez. So he's coming in. He only has 84 seats out of 350. And he's going to be leading this minority government with way under the seats that it needs to get anything passed. And every time he's going to get laws passed, he's going to have to come up with this kind of ad hoc coalition. And he's planning on using a whole range of very different parties. Catalan nationalists that want Catalonian independence, Basque nationalists that want this other region of Spain to be independent. Podemos, this new upstart, even more left-wing party, and he's got to kind of cobble that together on every single law. So no one is expecting this to be a stable government. Just about no one is expecting this to last until 2020. Mm-hmm. So they're now going to be in this situation with a very unstable government. And remember, they're still trying to keep their country together as well with everything going on in Catalonia.
So the uptick from all of this is that this is very politically dysfunctional. Europe, as it is constituted right now, it's kind of just a never-ending cycle of these types of problems within the governments of European countries.
Absolutely. And this political instability is just it's a symptom of just real crisis on the ground. I mean, you look at what's going on in Italy. Some of Italy's southern regions have 50% youth unemployment. You know, half of young people getting out of education, trying to find a job, they can't find one. Huge, just general unemployment as well. You go to Spain. Spain has, as of March this year, 35% youth unemployment across the country. So one in three young people can't find a job. And again, just like Italy, some of that is focused and concentrated in just really depressed regions. And you've had this going on since basically 2008. So you've had kind of like 10 years now of huge numbers of people being unable to find jobs. People just feeling like their career's gone now. They're wiped out. In Cyprus, you saw pensions, savings just lost overnight. So you've had this slow-burning economic crisis in Europe, and it's still there. And when you've got that kind of economic crisis, it's going to lead to these radical upheavals. It leads to this kind of shattering of the political system that we've seen in Italy that means nobody can form stable government. Or in Spain, that means nobody can form stable governments. That we're seeing in Italy, where you're having two parties that were basically either insignificant or non-existent just a few years ago running the country. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's still there. That's going to be a constant driver of just this uncertainty in Europe. That's why everything just feels so shifting and uncertain, and we have these surprise after surprise in Italy, and you know, everybody's having trouble forecasting what happens next because these are just not normal times.
So for those who would be interested in looking at this, putting it into its context of biblical prophecy, where would you send them for more information?
I'd send them to our book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, because the Bible does prophesy, you know, what happens next, not in terms of whether there'll be a confrontation between Italy and Germany in the next 6 months or 2 months, but the Bible gives a very clear discussion of where, or forecast of where Europe is heading. Revelation 17 especially, it makes clear that there's some big changes, some kind of revolution coming to Europe, and that's what you see brewing. It talks about a Europe made up of 10 nation state or 10 states that are really closely knit together, not 28 that are kind of loose and fighting each other. So yeah, the Bible makes clear there's revolution coming to Europe, and it makes the outcome clear as well. So yeah, that's talked about in Revelation 17, and our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, will take you through all of those prophecies and take you through where they're leading, which as Revelation 17 also brings out. It's leading to a definite goal, and there's a definite hope beyond that for a stability that Europe has just never known in the past.
Well, that's terrific. We appreciate that, Richard. And all of that really serves as interesting backdrop to our next story, Fresh Salvos in the Conflict Over Trade, as the White House imposes new tariffs this week on some traditional allies, including those in Europe. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we talked a few weeks ago about the Trump administration imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum from China, which is widely considered a U.S. rival. But as of midnight last night, they imposed a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum to take effect immediately on the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. Also widely considered U.S. allies. And while it's true, in, especially in the European Union's case, we've kind of been in a trade war with them since the 90s, this is just kind of a political escalation of that trend. Already, I mean, this just happened midnight last night. All three nations have talked about imposing retaliatory tariffs. In Europe's case, it doesn't look like it's going to be that bad. We might hear a little bit more of that later on, but it's they're mainly targeting Kentucky bourbon because the Senate Majority Leader is from Kentucky, so that's kind of like a personal way to get back on them passing this tariff. But in Mexico's case, they're going to be doing a lot of more agricultural products, which could sting a little more. And Canada's doing an exact tit for tat with putting tariffs on steel and aluminum, just like the Trump administration did on them.
Mm-hmm. And really, in all of these cases, anytime you have governments imposing these types of tariffs, no matter how justified they may be, you're running the risk of this escalating into a much bigger conflict.
Right. And in Canada's case, the U.S. relationship's pretty strong with them, so I don't know how seriously that rift's going to be, just if we're not trading steel and aluminum as freely as we used to. But in Mexico's case, I mean, they have an election coming up in July 1st. The front runner's kind of very much like a left-wing populist Bernie Sanders type, who may not get on with the United States as well as past Mexican leaders, and then with the other conflicts over the wall and immigration and stuff like that, our relationship with them's already kind of on the rocks. And now by imposing tariffs on both them and the European Union that runs both those tariffs may not affect the U.S. too bad economically, but it runs the political risk of pushing those two power blocks closer together.
Yeah, I think you can see that effect already. I mean, this is some of what we were talking about last week, where Angela Merkel visited Putin, visited China. And then you can see a certain amount of them all. They're all kind of talking about using less of the dollar. China's Global Times, just over a week ago, they talked about the real culprit is the monopoly of the U.S. dollar in the global market. They're saying that's at the core of this trade war. A few weeks before Vladimir Putin, he said the whole world sees the dollar monopoly is unreliable. It is dangerous for many, not only for us. Europe is looking at trying to trade more in oil, to trade more with Iran in dollars, trade with everybody in dollars to kind of distance themselves from the effects of American sanctions. You've also got people speculating that perhaps Europe will lift the sanctions on Russia that it introduced in concert with the United States. And that was probably some of what Angela Merkel was discussing with President Putin last week. So already you can see European leaders traveling around the world and you see this kind of block building. And then you had Japan as well. They're impacted by this tariffs. They might escalate. And there's a kind of a rapprochement to a certain extent between Japan and China brought about by these tariffs. So you can see all of these world leaders talking to each other, coordinating, putting together, I'm talking about putting together their own non-dollar denominated economic system.
And there is talk about the possibility of this escalating even further, Trump imposing tariffs on German cars, isn't there, Richard?
That's right. It's been something that's been, I mean, the German media is in a frenzy over this. There was one even claiming the Wirtschaft Woche had an exclusive report saying that they're talking, that Mr. Trump is talking about even a total ban on German luxury cars from the U.S., from America. But definitely they've been talking about tariffs, and this is huge for Germany. 50% of Germany's economy is in exports. One in four German workers work producing exports. So if things like the car industry start to get hit, well, that can feed directly into unemployment. It can feed directly into economic slack. And then they're so dependent even on importing to the United, on selling to the United States, that starts cutting off it very directly. I mean, it can lead to America can single-handedly cause a slowdown in Germany's economy. That's, they're in relatively good times and they've got these political troubles with the Alternative for Deutschland. This can be hugely destabling to Germany economically. And then even, Germany's very proud of its economic miracle, its Wirtschaftswunder. And its car industry is right at the heart of that. It's a kind of, the nation can no longer really in good conscience right now feel proud of its military, so it feels proud of its economy. And at the forefront is those German car brands. So you're attacking Germany psychologically, economically. It's something that can have a huge effect on the nation.
You know, this stands to be a huge geopolitical shift, this break between the United States and Europe. I mean, if you look back over the course of the past century, I mean, obviously World War II was basically the United States versus Germany at war. But since then, you transitioned into the Cold War, and with the Marshall Plan, I mean, the United States rebuilt Europe. The CIA provided like 50% of the funding in the early days of the formatting the movement to make a united Europe. So in a lot of ways, the United States has funded and directed and built up this whole United States of Europe concept to be a strong U.S. ally against Eastern powers like Russia and China. And from the 50s through the 80s, that alliance was just really strong with both kind of like a united or a uniting Europe and the United States kind of standing against the Soviet Union. But within the last couple decades, this new European superpower that the United States has helped build has kind of been going its own way in terms of foreign policy and economic policy. And now with, even with the breakdown of the Iran deal a little bit ago, they had one of the leading officials in the European Union was talking about, well, Europe needs to replace the U.S. as the new superpower and take the lead in these type of things. Now, with these tariffs, you're seeing this breakdown of where Europe is no longer like an economic colony or an economic support for the United States, but it's kind of its own economic and developing military superpower that may start forming alliances with that was initially built to oppose, like with Russia or with China or even with Mexico, and kind of a I've heard it likened before, actually. Well, Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, in the 1950s likened the United States of Europe to kind of like a Frankenstein monster that was eventually going to turn on its maker, mm-hmm. the United States. And he based that on some pretty sobering prophecies in the Bible. About 1/3 of the Bible is prophecy, and you can't understand most of it unless you know the modern identity of nations. And we'll have some resources we'll put in the show notes of the show to help explain those identities. But once you realize that the United States is literally the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel, and the Germans are literally the modern-day descendants of ancient Assyria. And they have a prophecy in Ezekiel 23 that talks about the Israelites and the Assyrians and the end time. No, but it actually likens as end time descendants of Israel to two sisters that get involved in an adulterous affair with a princes from Assyria. And the verses are quite graphic, but they go through about these two sisters, and they've got this affair with these Assyrian princes, but then they're cheating on their husband, which is God. And then eventually these princes that they have this affair with turn on them and enslave them. And if you carry the analogy out with these princes being German princes and these sisters being Israelite sisters, this is an Israelite people who had a history with God and who've lost their faith in him and instead developed these political alliances with Germany. And it's just a warning that these new lovers, they don't have their best interest at heart. They will eventually turn on them. And mm-hmm. that is kind of just a really graphic analogy of what you've seen for the past 50 years on the geopolitical scene, where you've got these Israelite nations, America and Britain, who've had a declining faith in God, turning away from some of the biblical principles they once understood, building up this German-led superpower to help protect them from some of these rogue nations around the world. But God's saying that eventually that alliance is going to snap, and this new European power they've helped built up is actually going to be the one that comes against them in trade war and eventually military war.
Right. So I guess what Donald Trump has done is kind of forcing the issue in some ways. It's uncovering a lot of this conflict that has been, the seeds have been sown for a long time for those prophecies to be fulfilled. So we definitely need to keep our eye on how that unfolds exactly. But that prophetic context definitely helps us to understand what we see today in the proper perspective. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Talks between Russia and Israel this week could have an effect on Iran's ambitions in the region. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the Israelis and the Russians have been very busy conducting numerous meetings. Mr. Netanyahu's called up Putin, but he talked with Lavrov, the foreign minister from Russia. And then just yesterday, you had the defense ministers of both nations discussing what they're going to do in southern Syria and Syria as a whole. Israel, of course, has their red lines as far as what they're going to tolerate with Iran's movements in Syria. We've talked about this the last couple of weeks, how Iran has taken to using Syria as this forward projecting base to attack Israel. Israel doesn't want that. They have retaliated with numerous strikes. And in the middle of this, you have both Russia and the Syrian regime being an ally of Iran and Russia. And so you have Israel talking to the Russians to try and limit what Iran is doing. And you also have the Russians wanting to talk to the Israelis to try and limit what the Israelis are doing as far as retaliatory strikes inside Syria. So this week you had numerous meetings, and a couple of things to come out of these meetings was one, Sergei Lavrov saying that in the end, all foreign nations should be out of Syria. And then he was questioned, do you mean Iran or do you mean the United States? And he said, no, all of them. And so he's saying in the end game in Syria, Iran should not be there. And then there in the meeting today yesterday that took place between the defense ministers, it looks like a deal has been struck where Russia is going to force out of southwestern Syria the Iranians. That was kind of a red line for Israel. You can't let them get close to our border on the Golan Heights. And for that, Israel has agreed to not strike Assad regime forces, but Russia has given Israel the green light to strike Iranian forces throughout Syria. So it's looking like through these meetings that the Russians are trying to consolidate the gains that they've made over the past 3 years in Syria, preserving the Syrian regime, ensuring that Russia is one of the most dominant forces projecting forward in Syria, their naval bases there, also the economic deals that they want with the Syrian regime to rebuild the nation. That's pretty big. Iran wants in on them. The Syrian regime has said no. Russia's got most of them. And so they're trying to keep it calm, whereas Iran is trying to use now their gains in the Syrian regime to get at Israel. And there is a big split here between the Russians and the Iranians over the future of Syria.
So much of the time in the past, we've seen this alignment between Russia and Iran. And here, just in the last, what has it been, maybe a year less, that we've seen this daylight emerging between Russia and Iran. And Iran, I mean, really, Russia has been a pretty significant backer of Iranian interests in the region. And now Iran seems to be losing that support. What do you make of that?
Well, this is something that we kind of expect to happen because once, of course, it was the Iranians that reached out to the Russians back in 2015 and said, we can't do this without you. And hey, if we lose, or if the Syrian regime goes down, you lose what you want in Syria as well. And so Russia jumped on board and said yes. But the question always was going to be, what happens once or if they're successful at stabilizing the Syrian regime? Then you have both their interests that are going to collide. And so Russia is trying to work out a way that it is the decision maker in Syria and not Iran. And so they are worried, as we just mentioned, that Iran could really throw a spanner in the works, as we say in Australia, to decrease the gains that Russia has made. Israel, for its part, it does not want to tolerate Iran. It's Israel would tolerate a preserved Assad regime backed by Russia. They would tolerate that. That is seen as the devil that we know, as they say, rather than the devil that we don't know. We haven't seen an Assad that is fully in the back pocket of Iran or Iranian forces in Syria. And Israel doesn't want that. And so that's why we kind of see them making deals with the Russian side here.
So the Russians make this statement, and there's actually reports that that Iranian forces are complying, that they're moving out of southern Syria.
Yeah, there is the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. They reported that Iranian troops and Hezbollah fighters look like they were starting to pull back from the border on Israel. We can't overstate the fact that Iran did suffer a pretty major setback when Israel struck them a couple of weeks ago, the 50 different sites, 50 different armament storehouses inside Syria. And so they are concerned that their gains might be, if they don't at least go along with this for right now, that they might lose out fully inside Syria. But we don't know necessarily how or whether this is going to be the decisive factor that is going to remove Iranian interests from Syria. It is just very interesting, though, that the Russians look to be taking the Israeli side. I mean, you have the Assad regime controlling about 70% of Syria right now. It looks like there's going to be some stability there, and Iran could really mess that up for the Russians. Mm-hmm. And so this is interesting for us, of course, just because we see in the Bible that Iran is going to lose its sway inside Syria. And so we've been looking for how this would happen, and we didn't know necessarily how it would happen. But maybe the Russian movement here is furthering that prophecy.
Very interesting. If people wanted to read more about that prophecy, where would you send them, Brent?
They can read the classic article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End. They can also read an article I wrote a year ago about this, and that is called Get Ready for Drastic Change in Syria.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The alignment of Russia and China militarily continues to advance. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, officials from the militaries of Russia and China met in Beijing on Wednesday, and they set some plans in motion to deepen their military ties and also just to lift their military partnership up to what they called a new stage of cooperation. I'll just read a little bit from the official statement that was issued after these high-level talks. This statement said, quote, "The two sides reached broad consensus on current international and regional hotspot issues, and on further deepening Russia-China military cooperation. The two sides will firmly implement the important consensus reached by President Xi Jinping and President Putin, further enhance the level of bilateral military cooperation, and make positive efforts to help the strategic cooperation between the two militaries to take new steps in the new stage." So these are some bold statements and some really ambitious plans that they've laid out there. And really, this is just a continuation of efforts that we've seen over at least the last 15 years or so for Russia and China to increase their military might and combine their military might together. These are, you know, these nations have the world's second and third most powerful militaries. So the fact that they're working now to pull them together just has some really significant implications.
How much of this do you see as a direct opposition to the United States?
Quite a lot of it. They both feel encircled by the U.S. in a way, or at least they claim that they feel encircled. You know, the South China Sea there, the U.S. has been conducting more freedom of navigation operations through there, which just infuriates China. They claim that as their own territory. And then in Poland, you've got the Polish suddenly saying, we want to establish a permanent United States military base here, just to make sure that Russia can't invade us. And on a number of issues such as those, both Russia and China feel that they want to be able to keep the United States out of their backyards.
Mm-hmm. And a related story this week, Russia delivering fighter jets to China.
Right. Yes, this was on Tuesday that Russia announced that they'll be delivering 10 more of their Su-35 fighter jets to China's Air Force by the end of this year. So in 2016 and 2017, we saw Russia already deliver 14 of these very advanced $100 million jets to China's People's Liberation Army Air Force. So this latest delivery announced this week will bring the total number up to 24. And, you know, numerous nations have tried to buy these advanced aircraft from Russia, but so far China is the only one to receive delivery of them. And only one other nation has even been able to finalize a contract, and that's Indonesia. So this weapons deal between Russia and China just, you know, it provides concrete evidence of the high level of trust and cooperation between these two nations.
We're seeing a lot of deals, economic and military, among Asian nations, but really the relationship between Russia and China seems uniquely strong, and it seems like, especially militarily, it's just routine that we're hearing these kinds of headlines.
Yes, that's right. Since 2005, Russia and China have had dozens of joint military drills together, major drills, including a set right there in the Mediterranean Sea, which, you know, that's Europe's sort of their backyard there. And then in the Sea of Japan, they conducted major drills. It's so routine now that they hardly ever even get a whole lot of attention in the Western press. But it is these two both are revisionist powers. They want to bring an end to the area, to this era of U.S. dominance and to this kind of unipolar world. And so they have a lot to cooperate over.
Yeah. So Russia and China in prophecy, that's a booklet that we've offered for a long time. Watching these two powers in particular align the way that they are, quite significant as far as we're concerned.
Very significant, yes. For over half a century, The Trumpet and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, have been expecting Russia and China to partner up, and that's because Bible prophecy says in the end time, a Russia-China axis will lead a massive military bloc that ends up fielding an army larger than any the world has ever seen before. And the scriptures show that this bloc will play a major role in a nuclear World War III. And right now, when we see these two militaries of Russia and China coming closer and closer together, making major weapons deals, we really should see that as setting the stage for the next and final world war.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want more information about that, you can certainly look at Russia and China in Prophecy in our literature on thetrumpet.com. We also have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, an excellent article that gives you a lot of background as to just how important this trend is. Check that out at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, the largest rocket barrage from Gaza to hit Israel in years, a defense deal between Russia and India that puts America in a tough spot, and the lunacy taking place within the organization formerly known as the Boy Scouts of America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We've been following the onset of tensions between Iran and Israel, and this week, after the largest rocket barrage from Gaza in years, the Israelis put the blame squarely on Iran. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the prime minister basically came out with a statement and condemning the attack and blaming Iran. Iran obviously is the one that funds Islamic Jihad and Hamas inside the Gaza Strip. And so this attack, which was, as you said, the largest since 2014, it involved some 180 Iranian-made 120-millimeter mortar shells and then 107-millimeter rockets, and they were fired from the Gaza Strip border into southern Israel. A number of them hit or landed in community areas. I think the location that's getting the most press is the one that landed at a kindergarten. It hit a eucalyptus tree, this mortar, at a kindergarten in a nearby kibbutz, and then fell to the ground and exploded. You see shrapnel all over the kindergarten yard, wedged into the building. Thankfully, this was 30 minutes before the children actually got there. And so nobody was there at the time. But this was a very substantial attack. There were more fired, more of these mortars and rockets fired than in the last 3 years combined, and just fired in one day. So it certainly announces, or did announce, an uptick. This comes just after last week we reported about how Hamas said that its relationship with Iran was absolutely the best it's ever been. Its relationship with the Quds force, Qassam Soleimani, called him a brother, and talking about how he directs what we do here in the Gaza Strip. And so Israel was right to directly blame Iran for an attack on its citizens.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at this in the context of not only what we were talking about in the first half, the fact that that Iran is being somewhat isolated. At least its relationship with Russia and the support that it's received from Russia has been diminished. And yet it really is. You can view what happened here in the context of this more aggressive stance that Iran has been taking over a period of several months.
Yeah, we have to remember that Iran has got so many options as far as military. They don't have the largest conventional or most effective conventional military out there, but they're good at this type of thing. They're good at motivating proxies, using small pockets of resistance that are aligned with their thinking, and maximizing that to do the most damage. When you talk about this type of attack, will Israel be taken over from the Gaza Strip, or will these rockets have a effect as far as the stability of the state long term? Probably not, but it still does really threaten Israeli civilians. When you think about this, Hamas fires a rocket, or Islamic Jihad fires a rocket into Israel. They hit a civilian. That's horrific for the civilians there to live under that threat. They have about 10 seconds to find cover before a mortar blows up in their backyard. That's not a lot of time. And then if Israel responds like they did and thump Hamas in the Gaza Strip, then you have Palestinians killed. And that's another victory for Hamas and Iran as far as the international attention it's going to bring to the Palestinian cause. And really, if you look at the Gaza Strip, this is something we have expected to happen for over a decade. Our editor-in-chief wrote about this when Israel pulled out in 2005. He said that this was going to give this terrorist proxy of Iran a toehold right on Israel's doorstep. And that is exactly what has happened. If you want to read more about the prophecies for the Gaza Strip and Israel giving land for peace there and its long-term effect on Israel, you can go ahead and read his book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Jerusalem in Prophecy. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Just go down to the literature tab and look at what you're looking at. It says showcase. Just move that down to all, and you can find that booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, there and on the website. We appreciate that, Brent. Israel is shopping for advanced air defense systems from Russia, and it puts America in a tough situation. To learn why, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this week, India and Russia concluded price negotiations for India's military to buy 5 regiments of Russia's S-400 advanced anti-aircraft weapons system. So this is it's a top-of-the-line mobile surface-to-air missile system, and the deal is worth almost $6 billion. And it's a big development because there's only a small handful of countries that Russia has sold the S-400 to. Several nations are trying to buy these systems, especially in the Middle East, but the only confirmed completed purchases so far have been from Belarus, which is a very close ally to Moscow, and China, which, as we talked about in the first half, has been forming a very close partnership with Russia. So this is a very short list of nations, and now India is close to being on it. So it just shows that the Russia-India partnership is strong and poised to grow much stronger.
So putting this in context with what we were talking about earlier with Russia and China, India definitely factors in strongly with this developing Asian alliance.
Yes, that's right. The Trumpet has long said that India is almost certain to join an Asian military bloc that as we talked about, the Bible prophecy says will come together in the end time. And the scriptures get really detailed about this Asian bloc. There's one passage in the book of Ezekiel that shows that, it shows that Russia will be the lead nation in the bloc, but then in verse 5, it lists some of the other nations that will be part of it. And in verse 5 there, you see some ancient names for some of the main peoples that make up modern-day India. So in light of these scriptures, it's really significant to see India doing this massive weapons deal with Russia, even at risk of souring its relationship with the United States over this deal because of sanctions that the U.S. has on Russia right now. And we have an article called The Other Asian Powerhouse, India, that really thoroughly explains all of these scriptures, and it just shows where these trends are leading. So we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes.
Well, yeah, the angle of what it does to the United States and why it makes things difficult for the United States, that's definitely something worth mentioning. What is it that makes the fact that Russia and India are doing this deal that makes it difficult for the United States?
Well, right now the U.S. is sort of torn because they're very interested in forming a close bond with India, mostly to as part of the strategy to be able to challenge China and Russia as well. And India is just such a powerful potential ally for America with the common language and things like that. But the U.S. also, back in August, President Trump signed into law the CAATSA, or the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. And this directly hit Russia, but it also includes secondary sanctions that can be placed on any country that enters into high-value deals to obtain military hardware from Russia. So right now, the Trump administration kind of has to choose between either punishing India for violating these sanctions or letting it slide in order to avoid souring that really valuable partnership between India and the U.S. So I think the fact that India is going through with this deal despite those sanctions shows that the leadership there in New Delhi are, you know, they're willing to risk, at least possibly risk, the U.S.-India relationship in order to build closer ties with Russia.
Mm-hmm. And is there any indication of American response to this announcement?
So far, there's not been a response. This was only announced a couple of days ago, but it'll be really interesting to see how President Trump reacts to it.
Yeah, the making pronouncements about the way that you're going to handle certain things, when you start to see ripple effects and you have to make adjustments based on the realities of the situation. This is an excellent example of just maybe unintended consequences for some of those decisions that President Trump is making. But do keep us apprised of what happens there. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. If you want a picture of where the United States is morally, look no further than the organization formerly known as the Boy Scouts of America. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Boy Scouts of America was established well over 100 years ago as an organization to help teach boys and young men masculinity and responsibility and survival skills, and really ballooned out to where in the 60s it had well over 4 million members that they were teaching these life skills to. But for the past half century, they've fallen on hard times, and especially in the past 5 years. Since the 60s, their membership's been in decline, primarily due to more young boys being interested in video games and other indoor activities than actually camping and hiking and the like. Mm-hmm. But since about 2013, they've really tried to just throw open the doors, I guess, to as many members as they can get, with them opening us up to scouts openly involved in homosexual activity, which for an organization that has boys under 17, it's kind of like, how would you even know? And then just a couple years later, then they opened it up to even homosexual scout leaders. Then they've moved into a couple years later, to 2017, into even transgender scouts, And as you mentioned at the beginning with the former Scouts of America, even earlier this year, they figured, well, now that they were accepting homosexuals and bisexuals and transgenders, there was really no reason to exclude girls. And so they actually dropped the boy from Boy Scouts and called it the Scouts BSA, which is a little strange in that BSA still stands for Boy Scouts of America, but it's definitely de-emphasizing the fact that gender even exists by just saying that this is just a scouting organization. So it obviously is not focusing anymore on a lot of the Judeo-Christian or biblical sexual purity that it once would have emphasized.
Yeah, that was actually in the Boy Scout oath. Well, for a long time. Is it still a part of the oath?
It is still technically part of the oath. I think they're looking at getting that changed because I was in the Scouts from like age 8 to age 12. And then when I learned it, that was the oath, which says, on my honor, I will do my best to do my duty to God and my country, to obey the Scout law, to help other people at all times, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that morally straight thing has people up in quite a hackles now because these days that phrase is almost applied exclusively to sexual orientation. Back in the 90s when I learned it, it was just kind of, I think, I morally don't even think I knew what homosexuality was at age seven. I just know morally straight's kind of like you're on the straight and narrow. You're on that, yep. Talks about in the Bible about like, blessed is he who enters in at the straight gate. Mm-hmm. So obviously the sexual purity thing was included, but as like one aspect of a much bigger lifestyle of being morally straight. Now they're trying to get that. They've definitely issued a statement trying to affirm to everyone that now that they're letting homosexuals and transgenders into the organization, that morally straight doesn't apply to sexuality, but I think they're looking at even getting that that phrase removed.
Right.
But
the idea that you can be morally straight and homosexual is a little bit laughable.
Right. That's what they're they do have an official Boy Scouts of America or Scouts BSA statement claiming you can be straight and homosexual. But they are looking at getting that changed, I believe. But as you mentioned at the beginning, this is almost kind of like a canary in the coal mine type thing, to where this was an organization that was founded on teaching morality to boys and teens. And now that they've got official declaration declaring even homosexual behavior to be moral, is something to where the Boy Scouts of America, I guess, kind of to their credit, held out a little longer than maybe society at general, but not much. Pretty much by the point that society got to where this was widely accepted as moral, the Boy Scouts also went widely accepted as moral. And they're in the news this week for that they're having their jamboree come up next month, and that's the annual. No, every 4 years, like the Scouts from all over the nation meet together, and it's now a bylaw that they have to provide free condoms at that jamboree, which is just another. They're touting it as like, well, this will make sure that there's no sexually transmitted disease, but it's also a sign that when you're giving out free condoms to kids who range between 10 and 17, that they're just saying, well, we expect you're going to be involved in some sexual activity at this jamboree. So here, have these free contraception.
It's just such a shame how much activities like this that are provided for young people. It seems like more and more you're hearing stories of just how much these types of things are being sexualized, and sexuality is being pushed on younger and younger people, even, you know, down to preschool and kindergarten age children who are being read books about homosexuality and transgenderism. And it's like there's this strong desire to make sure that the very youngest children are become aware of these things that, like you said, a generation ago, you wouldn't have even, it wouldn't have even crossed your mind. You know, the Boy Scouts, it was, you said it was meant to teach morality, but it wasn't like an organization that was trying to, you know, preach biblical morality to kids. It was just providing, you know, upbuilding activity that gave them something to do. And sex just wasn't a part of that experience at all. It's just a, it's a shame that, that it is, has turned into something so politicized and that they're bringing that into it more and more. But as you said, it is quite a reflection of what's happening society-wide. Well, that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the programs at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Robert Foreman Horton. Success lies not in achieving what you aim at, but in aiming at what you ought to achieve. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.